You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Looking for coverage of The Mandalorian Season 3? Well, this is the way, as we be talking about Chapter 21, The Pirate. My name is Mike Bloom, back to start off the back half of The Mandalorian Season 3 in a big way, in plot points that some may have thought we would be seeing 3 weeks from now, truly continuing to ask the question of where we go from here. Another really exciting episode of Mando to get into. Of course, I am not alone. Running the gun right next to me, decked out in his finest seaweed. It is the great DM Philly. Rich, how are you?
I'm so good. I didn't know this was a pirate episode, Mike. I'm very excited. This was a really fun week of Mando, and I'm psyched to break it down with you.
Yeah, do you think that people who perhaps watch the show through more nefarious means as part of a hive and scum and villainy saw the title and they're like, did they figure it out? Are they pointing at me?
Space pirates, pirates of the modern age. A lot of pirates out there, Mike. A lot of different types of pirates. I recently just rewatched Captain Phillips. Those guys were hardcore. You never know. Yep.
Yeah, look at me. I am the magistrate now. Here we are, chapter 21, and surprising in many ways as we come back around to a plot that was point that was brought up in the very first episode. The pirates wanting to sort of take revenge on Nevarro for cleaning up their act and no longer being welcome to their kind. How that brings in a very familiar face in the form of Captain Teva from last season.
and then ends up going the direction of how the Mandalorians get involved. And this was certainly a journey, I think, for me, because it took about, 40% of the episode, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is episode 5. Episode 5 of the Book of Boba Fett was the one that had no Boba Fett and just had the Mandalorian in it. Are we doing something similar here where we're not going to have Din Djarin in this episode whatsoever? But no, they do come back around, and I think it ends up leading to like a really emotionally satisfying conclusion, as well as a really fun cliffhanger at the end as well. So I feel like this episode had a lot of great stuff in it.
Yeah, I've been saying it a lot in the last couple of weeks, but this is quintessential Mandalorian. And I mean, it's quintessential Star Wars in so many ways, too. It's cheesy. It's fun. We got cool adventure. We got the lore. We got recurring characters. We got Easter eggs. But it's advancing the plot forward, right? I mean, a thing that LaTanya and Brendan and I talked about so much in the feedback show last week is like, we need some forward momentum. We need some conflict. We need like tension that's kind of hindering on a fulcrum. Everything felt like the status quo kind of stabilized a little bit by the end of episode 4, and we wanted some energy driving us forward towards the back half of the season, and some like, you know, narrative evolution. We wanted the story to go somewhere and the status quo to change. So I think this leaves us in a really fun spot for the end of the season.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we're going to have a literal change in HQ for the Mandalorians, if that symbolizes perhaps us moving things forward. Moff Gideon has come into the picture in a manner of speaking. Though it does crystallize, I think, a bit of a different surprise for me. I know this is something you discussed a bit in the feedback show as well. Rich, is The Mandalorian Season 3 less the story of Din Djarin and more the story of Bo-Katan Kreese?
Because I think it kind of is. Yeah,
like the growth that she has been experiencing, I would kind of argue is starting to supersede even some of Din Djarin's most prominent growth that he's shown over the course of 2 seasons.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about a lot in the feedback show last week. I think it was a really great discussion. And so much of what we got into was about the belief system of the Children of the Watch and extrapolating that onto Din Djarin. And Din is a character that doesn't give us a lot to work off of in terms of his internal motivations, his conflicts, his feelings. He's pretty simple. And I posit that his motivations are very straightforward in terms of he wants to protect his people. He wants to raise his son, right? And it's kind of that simple, but there's not that much development there. There's not that much kind of evolution for him to undergo. And because he doesn't articulate his perspective very often for us, we're kind of unmoored. We're not like right in the cockpit with him, like Grogu, where Bo-Katan is a character that has all this kind of outward history that we can attach onto and extrapolate off of. And she's much more emotive, right? I mean, literally we end up with her like, no, you're allowed to take your helmet off. You, amongst all of us, can have feelings and expressiveness and convey to us where you're at. And I think in a big way, she has like stepped up into that protagonist spot. She's earned that main credit kind of billing this season, Mike.
Yeah, and she might arguably be the Mandalorian of season 3, considering that, to your point, I think her arc, her sort of ebb and flow of a relationship with the Children of the Watch, certainly I think is a more of an interesting plot point. I mean, I think it was both a good and a bad thing that Din earns redemption within the first 3 episodes of this season, right? He walked into the living waters, fell into the living waters, comes out of it, gets redeemed, everything is totally fine. And while he does seem as more the emotional anchor now that everyone kind of turns to and says, no, he's good, he's with me, let's go ahead and do this thing, I do think that if you're looking for more of like the character-based emotional anchor of the show, it has become Bo-Katan, which I think is a really interesting choice.
She got the closing hero shot, right? We got the big lingering like 10-second hero shot at the end of the episode. Another thing, you know, we talked about in the feedback show was this question of like, gosh, is The Mandalorian Season 3 good? Is it bad? Do we have a feeling yet? And I think we landed on like, well, we'll see in a few more episodes how we actually land on it. But I'm really digging it. I think the inclusion of Bo with Din and Grogu, just it's really fun, you know, and giving them like a third kind of wheel to bounce the energy off of has become very dynamic in a way that I'm excited about. I mean, I've made no bones about the fact that I'm like super excited to track this character all season. I'm like fine with Bo-Katan being the titular Mandalorian, but it's working for me, certainly.
Yeah, I'd be intrigued to hear other people out there, right? Your Rob Cesternino's that are like, oh, all I really care about is Din Djarin and Grogu. Mm-hmm. When they are less of a focus and it's more about this character that got introduced halfway through the second season and made a couple of appearances, you probably feel a certain way about it. For what it's worth, I really enjoy it because, again, that does feel more of a character enriching journey for me. She very much represents an audience analog to me into the Children of the Watch, considering how devout Din has been for the entire time that we knew him. There wasn't a lot of, like, exploration about his character within that sect. Maybe he does have a bit of a crisis of faith, but he is brought back into the fold. I feel like Bo-Katan is the one to really represent that. Oh, you all do this? This is interesting. Okay, a little antiquated, but I can understand why you do it. And it's been really fun to have. Just interesting compared to, again, what the main billing of the show leads us to believe, which also feels like a bit of an MO of The Mandalorian in the first place, considering, you know, one of the major surprises in the very first episode of the damn show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're spot on, I think, right? She is able to articulate a lot of the ideas that we're feeling as the audience of like, what? But what's up with the helmet thing? But like, so how do we eat dinner? What are we doing here, guys? You know, and there's energy in that and there's fun in that, right? It makes it really easy for us to onboard with her coming in to this very kind of alien sect of people that have a disparate belief from our.
So let's start the episode in a very different place. The previously on, which I am actually very much tuned into. I know that some people like to skip forward because they don't want to be spoiled about like, oh, you reintroduced this character in the previously on so that we would remember their surprise appearance in the episode. But considering how much we've talked previously in the past few weeks about how we don't exactly know where the show's going, and that is exciting. I actually like those kind of waypoints in the form of, hey, remember this thing? This one really focused on the stuff going on in Navarro in the first episode. It also features stuff about the Darksaber, which didn't really have a lot to do about this episode, though maybe we can talk about that later, and it's something I missed. But we continue on Navarro to start the episode. Everything's hunky-dory. The IG-11 statue is, like, half-assembled. It's at half-mast right now. But it's about to be shot to bits alongside with a lot of the town square as Gorian Shard's ship has shown up for revenge. And Gorian Shard is going to talk to Karga here, basically saying like, ah, oh, you're a pampered nobleman. You gunned down my men in cold blood. Even though I love Karga saying that he shot first, even though we'll talk about this, Vane, the one guy that they did like gun down first, seemed to be the sole survivor from this attack, which, again, it's Star Wars. Nobody dies, but I found a very surprising plot point.
Yeah, Vane, a real cagey pirate, Mike. He's got some like half-orc racial features where he gets back up when he hits zero hit points. I love the return of Gorian Shard. This whole like you shot first thing, I know there's like the perpetual debate of like too far, but I loved you shot first. Like I really enjoyed the it's a trap bit with the Mon Calamari a couple of weeks ago, and Vane just being like, now I shoot first. Like, yep, this works. I mean, come on, he's the like ultimate mustache twirling Star Wars villain, like literally just flying in circles over the city while he rains down this bombardment, you know. And Vane is like the absolute ultimate, like slimy, you know, 80s villain sidekick, Mike. Like he's got huge Starscream upside.
I was gonna say, you said Starscream. I was gonna say it because he spent the entire episode in a ship, he reminded me so much of like the Star Wolf baddies from the Star Wars games.
Yes.
Your daddy precisely screamed real good when I killed him. Like big Pygma vibes for Vane.
I'm like
Vane.
Huge on. I'm like so ready for Vane to show up in the finale with Moff Gideon, like only to get his head caved in by Grogu. Like, what, you know, I'm here for it.
Yeah, exactly. These are not emotionally complicated villains. And some, I would imagine, feel that they're a little bit empty because they're just pirates. But I think this is a little bit of, again, that surface level entertainment that we get from The Mandalorian of like the popcorn fun of here are some space pirates firing down upon Navarro. It makes sense, actually, even, you know, without diving too much into it, why they would be so interested in Navarro. Clearly, it is in a name, though I will say these pirates continue to mystify me with just how stupid they are to prove a point.
Very stupid.
In the first episode, right, it's, oh, but we want to drink in the school. Come on, Greef Karga, let us drink in the school. Now in this episode, they're like, well, we're just going to lay waste to this entire town so that we can kick up our heels and sit back in it. We don't mind slumming it amongst the wreckage that we ourselves caused.
It really is a bit much of like the salt the earth strategy that they come in with. I kind of love them all just getting blind drunk and wandering through the streets shooting at the Kowakian lizard monkeys, you know, like yes, this is not like a tactical deployment that they've had. And I do think that we're getting these allusions to like, hey, there's more than meets the eye here, to really like keep the Transformers analogy on point. Like this notion that to some degree these pirates may be affiliated with Gideon and may have like a greater mission here, right? They were like sent here to kind of stir up the hornet's nest or whatever the case may be. It is just like mayhem and destruction, right? I mean, it's real like pirate pillaging energy happening.
Yeah, and it's rough. Navarro's been through a lot, man. It has unfortunately been the hub of so many attacks on it, particularly in the first season, and it seemed like everything was on the rise. And now we're sort of back to square one as everyone is displaced from their town onto the lava flats. Much more jaunty music takes us to a New Republic outpost where we see a couple of familiar faces in very different ways. First, let's talk about the familiar to Mandalorian fans. This episode brings the return of Paul Sun-Hyung Lee as Captain Carson Teva. This was one of the New Republic pilots that, you know, flagged down Din in episode 2 with the frog lady. And then he's someone who ends up saving Din in the end when they're fighting a bunch against all the big spiders in the ice cave. Nice to see him return here. But, Rich, for those that are deeper fans of especially other works of Dave Filoni in the Star Wars verse, there is a much more exciting cameo.
Oh, this was such a moment, Mike. Brendan Fitzpatrick and I, if you listen to any of the feedback podcasts, you will hear us bring up Star Wars Rebels as one of these absolute kind of pinnacle Star Wars shows that's out there. It's an animated series. It was definitely oriented like towards kids and a more youthful audience, but it finds its footing along the way. It's like 4 seasons, 75 episodes. And this is Zeb, this alien guy that we meet in the Rebel base. First of all, that music was bopping, man.
Oh, so good. Cantina adjacent, I would say.
For real. Not since Niamos a few months ago was I like this hype on a Star Wars jam. I was like, this is great. This is going on my Star Wars and chill playlist. Like, immediately, I loved it. And we stop in at this Rebel base, which was very cool. Big kind of like Yavin Endor vibes of like the jungles, the tropic, the greenery, you know. I like that kind of like visual mirroring that we get. And yeah, this is Zeb. He basically was one of like the main cast on Star Wars Rebels. He's a crew on the Ghost. This is like a huge Filoni property. Dave Filoni, like one of the major minds behind that show, a passion project of his. He loves these characters, and a lot of them are going to be getting rolled out over the next year between the back half of The Mandalorian and Ahsoka coming up. But yeah, Zeb is cool. He's a Lasat, I guess, is the type of alien that he is. I don't know much about them. He's got a really like deep and interesting history if you crack into Rebels and get into it, but he's that, I don't want to reduce him down to like grog strong jaw levels, Mike, but he's that guy, you know.
Okay.
He's the big tough bruiser strong guy who like a good comedic relief, like maybe not the like most tactically minded of their whole crew, but the dude with the big gun and the big armor who can like take a beating and knock a door down when push comes to shove, right?
Yeah, so it's awesome to see after we saw Cad Bane in the Book of Boba Fett, right? Like slowly these live action versions of these animated characters coming to life. I do have a long flight coming up, and I do plan to finally take the dive into Star Wars Rebels when I have an excuse to just sit still for hours at a time. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited to do so because I do want to finish it before Ahsoka starts for obvious reasons, given the connections there. And now getting to see Zeb is another reason to also maybe look forward to some other live action cameos, perhaps, in The Mandalorian.
He looked so good, Mike, right?
He
like
did,
we've talked about the varying kind of live action appearances, and you go to like a Cad Bane that like may or may not have worked for you given his depiction, but like I thought Zeb looked great. There was like a lot of question of like, oh, is that Zeb? Is this supposed to be another one of like his peoples? But it is in fact voiced by the same actor, and it really was like a great moment for me, like an awesome little stinger. And I like that we didn't lean on it too much,
yeah.
Right? There's like a world where Zeb's like, let me jump in the ship and go with you, Captain, you know, and he didn't. And I appreciate that, the like wink and a nod of like, no, this maps to the context, like where he would be. Rebels, like, if it's not clear, they're deeply affiliated with the rebels, you know, with the Rebel Alliance. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I totally agree that I think even when you bring in characters to a large extent, like a Bo-Katan or an Ahsoka, that they did it in a way that made more casual Mandalorian-only fans still care about them. Mandalorian-only fans sounds like a very bad site.
Oh, yeah, gosh, that's a website, huh? It's a lot of the helmet and the living waters.
Take off the helmet and maybe something else. But Teva is going to take matters into his own hands right now, right, where he gets this distress call from Greef Karga. Help me, Captain Teva, you're my only hope. And he's like, yeah, I guess I'm going to take this to Coruscant and try to get through as much red tape as possible here, because it's interesting to see his perspective of a character that, honestly, I didn't really give two licks about. It was fun to see Paul Sun-Hyung Lee in a Star Wars role after the awesome role he played in Kim's Convenience. But now to get to see that, like, he is one of the good guys inside of an institution that is ever growing to be unreliable and to be one side of perhaps the same coin as the Empire, just in a messier, you know, less purposely evil way, in a manner of speaking. It was fun to see him make a bit of a face turn, I would say, in this episode, trying to stick up for the little guy in the form of Navarro.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, as many like Mandalorian darts as I shot from my little wrist rocket at that episode three, Mike, I did think there were a lot of fun ideas there. And the notion that we get to like examine the disconnect a little bit between like the rebellion fighters on the field, right? We get from like the captain that like he fought in the Rebel Alliance. He was like one of the rebel freedom fighters. And now in the aftermath of this fledgling government, the disconnect and the inability for the bureaucracy and like the limited resources to affect the change that you were idealizing that actualized your whole kind of revolution. It's a lot easier said than done, right? And and I like this also because I think it's a little bit of a more charitable depiction. Charitable may even be a reach, but it's just more understandable for how you have this kind of systemic failure in a fledgling government of like, we don't have the resources, we don't have the manpower, we don't have the money, we don't even really know what planet you're talking about, dude. And we've got a list of people that actually are on the list of like official, you know, New Republic planets that we can't go help. So like, sorry, but they're at the bottom of the queue, you know. I thought it's like, I really liked this viewpoint into why is the New Republic failing, right?
Yeah. And this is something that I, not to cross the streams too much, but I've talked about a lot with Jessica Leese on our Star Trek Picard podcast.
Oh, cool.
Because Star Trek Picard in particular has really tried to take this MO in its series of like, not Starfleet equals bad necessarily, but Starfleet should not be looked at as the giant beacon of hope that can do no wrong, as maybe we thought a few years ago. And I think that speaks to your point, the fact that as a society, individualistically, we are starting to sort of question the systems that we work under and whether or not we should actually be operating in it, warts and all. I mean, this is going to be an odd comparison, but like, The Mandalorian season three is a bit of The Wire to me, in that the children of the Watch and now the New Republic, we are starting to dissect these larger institutions that people kind of blindly follow to say, no, there's a lot more rot underneath these floorboards than you thought when you initially bought the house.
1,000,000%, you know, I mean, there's all this discourse around Star Wars and politics and keep your Star politics out of my entertainment. And I have a very like cavalier and kind of hyperbolic response of like, but it's always been about politics, right?
Yeah.
It's always been a commentary on socially where we find ourselves. George Lucas is a guy who's making these films in the 70s in a time of like kind of great pessimism nationally in the US. And he's looking back and very much doing that thing that we did at the time of elevating the greatest generation, right? Mm. The Rebel Alliance are like the good guy ragtag like heroes of World War II fighting against the imperial fascist regime closing in on us. And as we're literally approaching the 50-year anniversary of Star Wars is coming up, which is like wild to kind of like say that it's closing in. But the reality is that we're in a place now where socially we have a different set of lenses on that we're like taking our media in through. and we have a capacity for more critical discussion and critical thought around the kind of the social pillars that we elevate and that we like aspire to be better than they could be. So to take the more critical view of like this new fledgling government and the new republic and the rebel alliance and like take the rose-colored glasses off a little bit of like it's not just a white hat, black hat situation is really compelling, you know? I mean, I think it's Star Wars, like it's about wars in the stars, which therein gives us a great vehicle to like explore this kind of stuff, right? So I'm here for it for sure.
I agree. So Teyva's going to make his way to Coruscant once again. And this is when, again, I'm starting to look at the clock and I'm like, oh, okay. We really are not focusing on these Mandalorians whatsoever, as he's going to pay a visit to the office of Colonel Tuttle, which first off, A plus Star Wars name, absolutely adore. And then secondly, A plus casting in the form of Tim Meadows, who we knew was going to be appearing in some capacity, but now his role was confirmed as the like, sort of beleaguered, but I think also jaded worker here that is in charge of sort of divvying up all the jobs to these New Republic fighters as to what to go out and do. I think Tim Meadows is the perfect casting for this. Very much brought me vibes of his character in Mean Girls, right? The official who like doesn't seem like a bad guy, a little disaffected, right? I think by this idea of, well, to your point, we have an organ donor list and certain people bump themselves up on the list by being part of the New Republic. So sorry, can't help you. But he still seems a little overwhelmed when we first, you know, meet him. He's getting paperwork constantly piled up onto his desk. But I think the more interesting thing to take away from the visit to his office, who is also there behind a desk, seems like Alaya Kane has worked her way up from the amnesty program and is now serving as, I don't know if it's his assistant or just somebody in his office that he can consult with, but very interesting to see her showing her face around there.
I'm just 100% with you. Colonel Tuttle is like such a Star Wars name, and the Tim Meadows casting here of like this dry, kind of jaded, if slightly optimistic and like benevolent middle management bureaucrat was like just so perfect, dude. He's so like you don't really like hate him. There's not like contempt or disdain, but he's so kind of like over it, overworked, overextended, you know. And the Elia Kane beat there, I just took her to be like a kind of busybody in the office, right? She like catches this visitor coming in to like meet with the boss and is like, oh, I'm gonna go bring these TPS reports in right now, you know, and like get all this signed off. She seemed like it was just like a tactical maneuver that was quite effective. For while I may not love the character, she is certainly like achieving on her ideas here and like getting it done. But yeah, this Tim Meadows appearance like just cracked me up, dude.
Yeah,
as poor Captain Teyva's like, come on, man, we need help.
Yeah, he went from the ladies' man to the papers' man, considering just how much work he's buried in right now. There's some interesting beats from this, though. I mean, again, they are really underlining the point that you and I have made before of a two sides of the same coin when Kane says, oh, well, maybe this would be a way for us to flex on Navarro and show how they should really apply to be in the New Republic so they can get the aid they need. And Teyva just replies like, well, that's a really imperial way of thinking. Hint, hint, you know, could take the woman out of the empire, but you can't take the empire out of the woman. And it's clear to see like the disdain he has for her, which has me feeling a mixed way because A, we kind of saw through the Pershing side of things how unfair that type of bias can be sometimes because there are complicated people that were involved in the empire. But then at the same time, we also did see her do some like unquestionably evil things a couple episodes ago. And we are meant to really support Teyva.
It's really tricky, right? Because Teyva's like clearly got his prejudice that he's coming in with, and that's what is informing his response. But just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you, right? Like we also know, like, no, you should not trust this woman at all. She is a sociopath. She melted Pershing's head, and like Tim Meadows is totally just going to defend her because of the position that she's in, right? Because like she is this kind of part of a marginalized population, and you have to kind of go at it of your way to defend that. So it's a very sort of complex, like, emotional triangle that's happening in this little tiny beat of a scene here, right? And I love that we see that from Teyva. Again, this soldier on the field, so far removed from the kind of, like, bureaucratic maneuvers of this new government. He's out there in the outer rim, like, boots on the ground, dealing with people. And he's still got that little bit of, like, soldiers kind of contempt for the enemy, right? Of, like, how are you going to, like, take them in so easily? How are we going to, like, let them come sit in the halls of power and, like, the spaces of our decision-making here? And he's not wrong, which is tricky. And I kind of love how nuanced it all is, right?
Given the ending of the episode, this was a big question we had leaving in episode three was, okay, was Kane in erasing so much of Pershing's memory? Was she doing stuff to work for Moff Gideon behind the scenes with his rise to power? Was she just doing it to clean up her own tracks? Has the needle moved for you in either direction given her second appearance as well as the end of this episode?
Yeah, I think I'm, like, much more in your camp, right? I have this thing where I overcomplicate everything, Mike. I'm like, no. Gideon cannot be coming back. We're teasing Thrawn. It would be ridiculous for us to tease Gideon. But they did say right in the episode, like, we think Moff Gideon escaped from the prison transport. Like, I do think at this point, like, in my mind, with the lack of clarity as to why she kind of, like, deals with the brain dialer on the mind flayer at the end there, it felt to me like, oh, she's going to radicalize him. She wants to actualize this guy to, like, fight against the alliance. We're going to come back to this relationship between the two. But the further away we get from it, the more it's like, oh, no, she just melted that guy's brain so he can't say anything to anybody ever again. Yeah. And it is just very straightforward that she's still working for the same bad guy who will show up in the end to be like, ah, ha, ha, somehow I returned. So, yep.
Yeah, I totally agree that I feel like the needle has moved even further with the Grand Conspiracy, not Grand Admiral Thrawn Conspiracy, but I guess the Gideon Conspiracy, that he has indeed escaped and she has been somehow helping behind the scenes to push forward the plans that were abandoned for a period of time. And so Teyva has been abandoned as well, but he decides to take matters into his own hands as we go to, for possibly the last time, Rich, unnamed Mandalorian HQ. Here to make his formal plea.
It's Jurassic World, though. I thought that that's what we...
Yeah, well, nary dinosaurs to be found, at least in this instance. It'd be really funny if Teyva shows up and then just, like, one of the raptors comes and swoops him up.
Grabs away. The ship, yep.
Like, he's trying to be Samuel Jackson in Deep Blue Sea, making this big, passionate monologue about why they need to help, and then one of those plesiosaurs just comes and grabs him and eats him.
Yeah, it's finally time for them to get off this Jurassic World. Way too many children getting eaten by prehistoric beasts on this place.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Yeah, so he is going to make his pitch right now. Luckily, all the guns get brought down. You know, initially Paz Vizsla comes up, starts bringing up the Gatling gun, like, get the hell off my lawn. But then Din's going to come in, step forward and say, like, don't worry, he's with me. Though we find out initially that R5 was a terrible decision to bring in many ways as far back as episode 2. One of them being, like, this dude was so easy to track for anyone who wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, is this not going to, like, trigger all of Din Djarin's PTSD around the droids again, Mike? Like, it took him so long to learn to trust.
Because I was right the first time.
It took him so long to trust synthetic people, and now R5 just totally burns him like this. The whole place, they have to move the whole car around. So here's the more pointed question, Mike. And again, like, don't dig too deep at Star Wars. You know, you may not like what you find in under the sands of Tatooine. But so presumably, R5 left Tatooine, fought in the Rebel Alliance, and then was returned to Tatooine and abandoned unceremoniously again, only to get picked up by Pelimoto and the Jawas like years later, so that he could then get repaired and sent out with Mando so that Captain Teva could be like, oh no, I know him. He's an old military buddy.
I kind of get it, though. It reminds me of a different shade of that one Obi-Wan Kenobi episode where we see the Temuera Morrison clone trooper, like, as an unhoused person on the street begging for food, that, like, it's the unfortunate struggle that some veterans experience, that, like, they don't know what to go back to after they've had their time in the war. No wonder this thing is a fraidy cat. It's seen a bunch of shit. And
yeah,
so I
guess that tracks,
I could imagine, yeah, after it's been through whatever it's been through, right? You know, the second Death Star explodes, and it's like, I just go back home. Please just settle down on the sands. I know a lot of stuff happens on Tatooine, but I'm going to stay in my own little quarter, and hopefully no one will come asking for adventure again.
It just always cracks me up when Star Wars has such kind of simple continuity somewhere, and then they really go out of their way to, like, complicate it overtly, you know? Back to, like, whatever it was, episode 2 of, like, Din Djarin flying in circles through the Mandalorian system of, like, no, we got to go back and see Bo-Katan again. I love it. That whole, like, little notion cracked me up. But, yeah, also, like, screw you, R5. Bad move. This is a bad move. This is not a good droid bro maneuver. Yeah,
we have R5. R5, and this may not be the last time. Like, I guess the Mandalorians are now out in the open, but I don't know. I'm of a certain mind that maybe R5 is going to betray the entire group eventually and rat him out to Aliyah Kane. And it turns out that R5 was the big bad all along.
Darth R5? Yeah, he's Darth, like, actually 5. On Gideon's payroll the whole time.
Exactly. Or Gideon, like, placed his mind in the form of that droid and has just been remote operating him the entire time. So Din is going to accept the mission at first, but he is just one man, one Mandalorian. And so he is going to make the formal pitch. I love the talking hammer that they have to hold from the armor. Of, like, all right, it's Din's turn to talk. Everyone be quiet. But he's going to sort of remind us about the complicated history the Mandalorians had with Devaro. Remember, they were operating their own little conclave underneath the surface. We're going to visit that forge later. And then when Din Djarin makes this grand escape with Grogu in episode 3 of season 1, the Mandalorians do join by his side. They provide enough of a distraction to get the two of them off planet. So suffice it to say, when they are asked to help the very people that fired against him 4 years ago at this point, they are not entirely happy. But Din is going to make an interesting point here, right? Less about who they're helping and more so where they're helping. And he invokes this thing that was brought up in the previously on, that at one time Greef Karga did offer him a tract of land for himself. Now, granted, part of that was to sweeten the deal to make him the marshal of Navarro in Cara Dune's absence. But he now is pulling that out of his pocket and saying, listen, it's about time we don't live in the shadows anymore. Let's live in the light. Like you said, we have too many kids who have essentially been homeschooled this entire time. Let's let our culture flourish. Let's let our kids play in the sunlight again. It may not be the two sons of Tatooine, but it's a place we can call home. And for a second, you think Paz Vizsla grabs the talking hammer and you say, okay, here comes the rebuttal, right? He was someone that was on the front lines of getting gunned down by Greef Karga and the people on Navarro. But it's shades of, you know, the end of Anchorman with Vince Vaughn's character of, I hate you, Burgundy, but God damn it, do I respect you. And yeah, it's a good thing that Din Djarin made that mission to save his son in the last episode, because as we predicted, he owes him one. And so that's going to lend Paz Vizsla to say, you have my Gatling gun.
I love this whole silly scene so much for so many reasons, right? The way it's kind of a foregone conclusion of Bo-Katan going to him, like, all right, what's the plan? I love that, like, these two are just in lockstep at this point. And I love that we get this callback. There was a ton of conversation in the Discord last week and all across the internet as we're, like, getting deeper into the Mandalorian season three. The questions around how should we look at the Children of the Watch? Mm-hmm. Should we look at them negatively, positively? Like, what do we think of their beliefs is becoming, like, more and more topical. And I just kept going back to that, like, gosh, man, the Children of the Watch, for all their weird faults and particular beliefs, they do, when push comes to shove, show up at the season one finale, and many of them die. They just die to protect Din and Grogu. And, like, this is the great sacrifice, right? This is presumably what these Mandalorians are all training for. I do also understand that they're extras. That was literally their job, to, like, show up that day on set. But nonetheless, I'm, like, glad that somebody in world, like, reminded us of that, and we're talking about that as being important, because I think, like, the ensuing time in the Mandalorian has been this time of, like, rebuilding for the Children of the Watch, and it's only just now that we see them with this kind of, like, robust community. There's enough of them that the dinosaurs can, like, sustain themselves eating their children day to day. So I love that the callback to the property and the Greef Karga bit earlier in the season, that was, like, there's a there was a reason, yeah, that we got that little, like, tidbit of, let's stop in on Nevarro, check in with Greef, get the vibe, and forget it, man, he wanted to hire a marshal, he's got a whole, like, sheriff's department armed in Beskar moving right in downtown. But all of this energy was great. The Survivor, yeah, Borneo talking hammer was, like, very fun. Like, I loved the whole thing so much, Mike, and, like, Grogu sitting quietly watching is, like, one of my underrated favorite things about these vibes, of him just, like, taking it all in, you know. And Paz Vizsla, like, many of us died for this tiny foundling, and I'm totally cool with it.
Yeah. I was like, and yes, I love him too. He's so cute. He's my second son, Ragnar too.
I just, all of it, like, worked, you know. Is it a little, like, shallow? Is it, like, on the nose and kind of, like, pulling at all these different nostalgia strings? Like, yes, for sure. But I think it's really effective, and I love it, you know.
Yeah, and I think it tracks for me. Now, again, as I mentioned in the beginning, I do feel like, I wouldn't say jumping the gun, but it's a little unexpected to me, because I think we have been 2 for 2 on Mandalorian finales of, okay, this is when the big team up happens to take down the big bad. And I think we're getting a smaller version of it here, and that, okay, here are all the Mandalorians working together to take down the big bad pirates, that the pirates felt like mid bosses even before this. And also that this happened much earlier makes me even more excited for, like, what the possibility of the finale could bring. But it doesn't feel completely like, okay, we're just going to help out this one friend of a friend who's having issues. Like, it does seem like with Din promising them a home, this is something they desire. This has been part of Mandalore culture for so long, is the lack of a home, is how displaced they are. And so I do think that is enough to push them over the line too.
Yeah, as much as, like, I take this stuff way too seriously, Mike, I got emotional, man. I got all verklempt as Din is like, I have a home. Let our, yeah, children live in the light. And I'm like, yes, dude, yes. This is, like, so awesome. And to have people, like, the whole beat that Bo-Katan's giving them, like, last time you were here, you fought against these men. Now we will return and be heroes. Like, dude, I love this energy. And then her, like, actualizing all of this information and background that she comes with, of like, okay, 10 of us are getting on this ship and we are going to operate as a highly trained military unit. She's got this one very small line: if everybody does as they should, we will overwhelm them, you know, despite our smaller numbers. And just, like, the way she talks about this stuff, if everybody does as they should, right? I don't know. I love it, Mike. I'm so here for, like, these big Mando army action set pieces. Like, yeah, yes, please.
Yeah, you get sweat up in it. It's very evocative to me of Star Wars. Really has made such an incredible mark on the world in general, but one of them being, like, the commercialization of the toy market, of the action figure market, all the way back, yeah, in the late 70s. And this reminded me of, like, getting a bunch of Mandalorian action figures together to fight against these random Trandoshans and Mon Calamaris and seaweed covered people. And I really enjoyed that set piece that exists here, as, yeah, basically the plan, right, is, like, hey, Bo-Katan and Din are going to distract with their big old fancy spaceships and help work on the hovering mass that's above the city. But other Mandalorians are just going to rain hellfire down upon these unsuspecting pirates. And that's basically what we get for the next 15 minutes. It's not a lot to talk about in terms of emotionality or character or anything, but it is really fun to watch. First off, just to watch these dumbass pirates get their butts handed to them. I did love the Transdotion who gets put on like the big sniper rifle.
Because
like the Transdotions are like a little cockeyed. It reminds me of like Steve Buscemi's pilot character from Mr. Deeds. Like, I would not put him as the mark for the best vision that be able to snipe all these Mandalorians from several clicks away.
No, they've got the real like chameleon eyes on the opposite sides of my head energy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a kind of ridiculous costume, you know. I love that he actually was hitting people though, Mike. I was like, this guy is no stormtrooper. He's actually like landing these blasters on people. The way that like the first kind of team gets hemmed in and we get the overhead shot, like I thought the blocking was actually like really great. Action, yeah. You know, we've talked about it, but action can be like tricky, and it's so easy to lose perspective on space and where people are and what's going on. And I just can't get enough of like the dogfighting, Mike, right? Like amidst the like years of Star Wars, there's so many awesome space battles. I think like when you open on Revenge of the Sith, that's one of my favorite like iconic ones, that whole big opening sequence of Anakin and Obi-Wan dropping in. But this like Din in the N1 and Bo in the Gauntlet, the two of them like consistently like in atmosphere fighting other ships has been such a treat. I really love it, and getting to like showcase all this stuff that we talked about with Pelimoto with the N1 of like, it's so fast. No, yeah. Really, it is so fast, and like he's above you, he's below you. It's very, very like cool, right? And honestly, like I'm a little conflicted with like, dude, you've got Grogu sitting in your lap on this tiny cockpit where like, certainly this is the first part of the ship to get shot, Din Djarin. Like, what are you doing, man? But also like, yeah, it's very cute, bro. Like, you probably better just keep Grogu right there in your lap for all the dogfighting. Sure.
I don't know. Paz Vizsla is now like his new pseudo daddy. Couldn't he carry him on his shoulder? Like, ah, let's take down these pirates together. Cause I agree. I don't want to go full goose here, but is there a possibility that like, if things go south, then there goes Grogu as well?
It just like, it's such a tiny cockpit. Like, he just like, he does not have a lot of like hood to deal with if he runs into anything there, you know. This is no Razor Crest. And then, yeah, dude, to see like Paz Vizsla ripping off with like the auto cannon and like the second team coming in, I liked seeing the Mandalorians like not just like roar through the street with no resistance to like the Beskar in play. Dudes are getting shot, people are falling over and like dragging each other behind barricades. Like, just great energy for this whole like storm the city. And the dynamic between like Navarro episode one, shiny new polished, oh my god, it's so cool, to the like shot as we drop back into Navarro here with like the blasted buildings and the blown down trees, I was like, oh yeah, this is working. Like, I feel bad for the cost of like Navarro in this attack, you know.
And I realized through this fight that my favorite character that I'd like to see combat over the course of the Mandalorian is the Armorer. Her just walking in a la Joel, another Pedro Pascal character, seeing the sniper and just smashing the heck out of him and all of his goons with just two hammers. We saw this the first time back during the Siege of Navarro in episode 3 of season 1. She's so freaking good. Like, you could say all she does is stand around and just spout wise about the way and everything like that. Does she really get her hands dirty? She does, and how. She can wield those hammers like no other.
Yeah, she shows up with those little pincher barbecue tongs and grabs that guy by the collar, right? She rolled like a 30 on her stealth check at disadvantage in the Beskar, which is really impressive. Like, I love the armor, and like getting to see her out there doing stuff is very cool. And we'll get there, but I love the callback that we go back underground to like see the forge. But the armor is very, very cool, man. Big shades of like the Chrono Grappler in Andor, you know, are like bell guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Hammers just work in these, you know, public situations where you're facing down with a larger enemy. And so we get a win here. Din and Bo just lay waste to the Gorian Shard ship, despite the fact that he takes the wheel at the end, he ends up leaning it straight down into a giant explosion. This made me laugh out loud that everyone's celebrating. It just cuts to the little Muppet Anzellan saying, "It's gonna be okay. It's gonna be okay."
I love the Anzellans, dude. The Anzellans like saying very dumb things with like goofy accents. It's like really one of my favorite things about this season. It's gonna be okay. It's gonna be okay.
Yeah, I'm surprised we didn't have Grief Karga be like, "They said it's going to be okay. Don't worry."
I did think it was like a really inspired shot to go into the Anzellan Enclave like, through the tiny like basement steam window, like kind of dryer vent outlet to like watch the combat outside. Like, I loved it. But yeah, I would have liked Grief to just clarify, like, "They said it's going to be okay."
Yeah, I thought the Anzellans for a second would go full Kevin McAllister and like set up some tripwires for the pirates or something.
Dude. I want that. That's like a whole animated spinoff right there. Give me Tales of the Anzellans next year, 2024. Do it, Filoni. I dare you.
Well, the dust has settled, and it is a victory for not only the people of Navarro, but the Mandalorians as well. And Karga goes through with his promises, much like a different pirate who unfortunately did not show his face in this episode. He always delivers. And so he officially cedes all land from the Western Lava Flats to Bullet Canyon to the Mandalorians, who may no longer have a home planet, but you do have a home. And yeah, Rich, much like you were talking about in the feedback show, I do feel like this is that necessary forward momentum. People do feel like they felt bogged down on Jurassic Park. Now we have a much cleaner pasture that they'll probably spend in the rest of the season and the intervening 2 to 3 years before season 4 beautifying and bringing up to a good city.
Yeah, I mean, look, I love it for the emotional beat of like, oh gosh, you guys like died here, you bled here, like you deserve a home. Let your diaspora like find your, you know, your new homeland is kind of great. But I just like the potential, like the idea that, you know, Din's whole story, while we talk about he hasn't had a ton of character development this season, the character development for the character thus far has been that as he kind of like more and more engages with people outside of the covert, his mind is opened, his world, his horizons are expanded, right? And so I think integrating the Children of the Watch with a community of people here where presumably they will be able to like interact every day, they're gonna have neighbors, they're gonna develop interpersonal relationships and come to like care about the community by letting them like have this public outward facing like place, an embassy of sorts or whatever in the middle of town, I think creates really great energy for them going forward. And I think that like to all of these questions that we've been having, because there really was so much kind of conversation, the whole feedback show sort of hinged on this discussion about how do we view the Children of the Watch? How do we feel about their radicalized religious beliefs, you know, and their kind of like zealotry to the way. And I think that putting them firmly here out in the open in the daylight with like an average, let's say typical community, just creates an opportunity to like break those barriers down a little bit, right? To interrogate like what they actually do believe, why they believe it, where those things like don't necessarily hold water, where the compromises are, and what they're willing to do as like part of a greater society, right? Rather than like their one little cell whose whole aim, to be clear, since we've met them, has been survive, right?
Yeah.
That's been like their only agenda. And this is that like that classic idea of like there needs to be more to life than just surviving, right? We need to live. And so I'm glad to give them this opportunity to like find themselves in that way.
Yeah, I mean, listen, allow me to touch the stove again and invoke a religious comparison, but it reminds me a bit of the series of events that led to the founding of Israel
100%.
Back in the 40s, right? This idea of like, you are a people who have faced persecution that due to escaping said persecution have been scattered to the winds in a million places. Let me find you that place that you need to go to settle into with your own people. Now, my hope is that it certainly does not put this territory in such a, you know, embroiled controversy as Israel has been involved in, especially nowadays. But I do think there is a bit of a comparison there.
I think it totally maps, right? And even to like take it the step further, I mean, the whole notion that like, no, we were here once and we had to hide underground, right? Like you kind of, nobody wanted us here. We didn't belong here. We didn't have a place here, even though this was our home. And the idea now that like the rest of the community can like accept them, celebrate them, embrace them. It's really empowering in that way of like, gosh, sometimes you have to learn lessons through like a hard cost, right? And the people of Navarro have like, learned that lesson to a degree. I'm extrapolating big time, but I think it maps still.
All right, well, let's go down to the Great Forge as we finish the episode 2 for 2 now with a conversation between the Armorer and Bo-Katan, which is slowly becoming one of the most interesting dynamics in the show here, as the Armorer, like the metal she works with, shows she's a little bit pliable. Whereas last episode, the pulse that we were getting, at least the read from her mask-covered face, is like, she gets told about the Mythosaur, doesn't necessarily believe it, is more so, yeah, you're in with us now, you're a child of the Watch, you have to follow these rules. Now she's a little more loosey-goosey. Maybe it's because they now have a home that they can settle into without fear of dinosaur attack. But she brings Bo-Katan down, asks her to take off her helmet, and I did think initially it was going to be like, ah, that was a trick, that was a test, you failed, you're exiled now. But she does, and the Armorer is pretty dang cards up about this. One of the most, I would say, you know, liberal amongst this sect of the Children of the Watch, essentially saying, like, we cannot exist as our own community. In order to repopulate the Mandalorians and make this as benevolent and, you know, populated of a people as they once were, we are going to need to loosen our restrictions a bit. And there is one person that can do that. And the thing that, you know, may have been the final nail to push me into this is the fact that you indeed saw the Mythosaur, which to me is a sign to herald in a possible new age of Mandalore.
I love this so much. You know, we've been talking all season about this notion of like, are these two going to fight? Is there going to be a conflict? Is the Armorer going to support like Bo-Katan's position? And Katie Sackhoff has been doing a ton of interviews this season, Mike, mm-hmm. and she's spoken probably a little bit out of turn. I've tried to like not get too spoilery, where very quickly after the Mythosaur episode and the spotting of it, she's like, look, like she's not sure how she feels. She's not sure what Bo-Katan's like, not certain if she even wants to believe that she saw that. The whole like beat of her not taking the Darksaber back. Katie was just talking about like, look, Bo-Katan is of a perspective that like maybe somebody else could do this. Like I have tried to unite the Mandalorians and like I just fail. I seem to fail at this, right? So the idea that we're now driving into this a little bit more and we're seeing the Armorer as this person that she's not a leader for the sake of like consolidating her own power, right? The Armorer is not a leader who is in that role because of her own egocentric drives or her own need to like hold dominion over others. Her whole focus is about like the preservation of their culture and this kind of intolerance for any kind of like dilution of the way. I think it conveys a lot now as we get to this point that she is willing to be like, no, you are not entirely one of us. You can be the brand ambassador. You need to go out there and find all these other Mandalorians that think that we're a bunch of yahoos because we hide in the sewers with our helmets on. And you need to like convince them that there's a home here for us, that we can like build something together if we can unify. And you need to be as approachable as possible. So our radicalized beliefs are not going to serve you here. Take your helmet off and go walk both worlds. I love that so much. And the fact that she's like the kingmaker, like I've always kind of perceived the Armorer that way. I never read the conflict coming between her and Bo because like this seems like the logical conclusion of like, oh no, this woman is like stepping up to like, you know, fit these kind of giant shoes that are waiting for her. And maybe she is the one that can do this. Very exciting. I'm really psyched. And I can't wait to see which Mandalorians are going to show up in these last 3 episodes, Mike.
Well, that's the main hole, unfortunately, with the argument. Again, it's awesome to see Bo-Katan be the one to get given this mission, considering that, to your point, it's always the time when you don't want opportunities that opportunities end up knocking at your door. The problem is she tells Din in the premiere episode, right, that all these people left her because she didn't have the Darksaber and decided to purposely cast themselves to the corners of the universe. How exactly is she going to be the one to bring them back? Is she going to ask to borrow the Darksaber? Maybe tell a little white lie, a little dark lie of like, oh no, I actually did win this from Din Djarin, so now I will lead you. Please, everyone, come to Navarro and let's settle down. I'm just having trouble with her trying to talk people back that have spurned her previously when really nothing has changed with her from at least like an external perspective.
Yeah, she and Din are going to load up and they're going to go do like the Katniss and Peeta Victor's tour, right? I mean, that's the deal. She needs to like bring, like they need to go together, I would think. But I also think it's going to be a matter of like individuals. I think there's like a few named Mandalorians floating around out there, like your Boba Fett's. Like, I wouldn't be surprised to see Boba Fett get dragged up. Like, bro, we need you to leave Tatooine. What are you really doing here anyway? You
can
just
I bring,
a bit of
can
a
I bring my back to tank?
Somebody get that back to tank on the ship. Come on, let's go, Boba Fett. There's a Sabine Wren, like, just waiting to show up out of Rebels. At, like, Bo-Katan's whole little kind of, like, her crew of, like, the elite couple that, that saved Grogu and Din last season. We'll see, but I don't think she's going alone, right? It feels to me like this is the setup for, like, I could see a world where, like, the beginning of next episode is us watching her fly away, but I also very much see the world where she and Din Djarin load up into a ship and are like, all right, let's go meet my friends.
Yeah, I think they make the sales pitch where it's like, you know, good cop, Darksaber cop, where she makes the emotional plea and then Din just waves the Darksaber like, oh, he has the Darksaber? Great, we're going to follow you, which is a very fun idea and I think still also pokes at this conflict of, okay, maybe she doesn't want the Darksaber, but her seeing the Mythosaur may have reinvigorated these ideas of her of, okay, maybe now she does actually want to lead these Mandalorian people. It's a really exciting prospect. And what makes it more exciting, Rich, is how we end this episode with the idea of possible dissension in the ranks and sabotage, Mandalore on Mandalore violence, perhaps. As Captain Teva, doing his patrol, he finds a Lambda shuttle that, of course, was going to be the prison transport for Moff Gideon, and Moff Gideon has escaped. He's been broken out, but the big thing to take away is what has been left behind, a shard of Beskar, implying that a Mandalorian or Mandalorians were the ones responsible for breaking Moff Gideon out.
Dude, I don't know what to think about this. I'm so all over the place. This is one of like the maybe clumsier beats in the episode of like, there's Beskar remnants in here. And I'm like, wait, isn't Beskar the most valuable resource that the Mandalorians could gather? Are they making Beskar bullets now? Because we've never seen that before. Why is the Beskar here?
Could be something out of Murder, She Wrote, where like the killer gets away and like tears a piece of their shirt right on a rusty nail. And so that fabric is left behind. That's what I feel it is. Just a piece of armor that got left behind in the shrapnel.
So there's a lot of interesting questions, and that's kind of where my head went of like, oh, was there a Mandalorian here that got blasted and there's like shrapnel on the wall? So why would the Mandalorians come take Moff Gideon? Well, if we could imagine a different radicalized sect that's not like the Children of the Watch, maybe they just took him to be like, bro, you don't go to court. We are going to execute you torturously. We're Mandalorians. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Maybe they're interrogating him for weaponry. Where the very most notable first Mandalorian that we met in Boba Fett was a mercenary, right? He's like hired as like a gun for hire when we meet him 40 years ago, rolling into the middle of these Star Wars movies. So the idea that like somebody in Beskar, again, go back to like season 2 of The Mandalorian and our Cobb Vanth, like just because the Beskar's there does not a Mandalorian make. What type of Mandalorian? What is this Mandalorian's motivations? And then I start going to like really crazy ideas, right? Of like Darth Maul and the Mandalorians and like this whole contingent of crazy militant Mandalorians that like took over Mandalore before the collapse. Like, I don't know, man, there could definitely be a contingent of like rogue Mandalorians out here that will serve as adversaries to Bo-Katan and Din Djarin. So I'm curious what that's going to look like.
Yeah, right now I'm going to go with Occam's Razor Crest, and I am going to believe that it is a sect of Mandalorians that at the end of season 2, right, they do end up leaving Moff Gideon on his knees, but Din Djarin says, no, let the authorities take him in, let the Empire deal with him the way that they should. We're not going to get our revenge here and spill blood. I would imagine that would tick off a certain sect of the Mandalorians, a certain group. And I wonder, we have not seen the character played by Sasha Banks, who was formerly part of Bo-Katan's clan. Maybe this is a way to bring her back in, that like maybe she's leading this radical group that is abducting him to say, no, you don't get a right to trial. You lay waste to so many of my brothers and sisters. You deserve nothing but the sword, my friend.
I do think that there is questions as to, like, we got Bo-Katan saying, like, everybody left me because I didn't have the Darksaber. I'm like, yeah, sure, but why did they really leave? Are we going to get, like, a flashback or clarity there? And I could very much see a world where that Sasha Banks character, where, like, she takes the Imperial kind of fighter or the Imperial ship that they took. They go back, they get Moff Gideon, and they're trying to like extract information out of him. Where is Thrawn? Where are the Imperial bases? Where is this or that? But that Gideon gets the upper hand and ultimately like kicks their asses and escaped. And I could see the world where, like, you know, Bo-Katan and Din Djarin are going to show up just in time to be like, oh wow, Moff Gideon really smoked you guys. It's a good thing we're here. We'll go get him back. Like, let's take care of it. And that's how they win over the rest of the Mandalorians' kind of respect. We'll see, I guess, but I'm really curious about it. My big question, though, Mike, I mean, it's a very small beat, but do you think that the armor is being like a little bit kind of greedy here with the whole, like, you've been given a homeland, at which point she's immediately like, and now we retake Mandalore? Like, Jesus, talk about an inch a mile over here. Yeah. Like, you didn't even move into the new apartment yet.
Yeah, I mean, it's understandable for her to have those aspirations, right? How long has she been living underground under these various planets for years upon years? She gets the first glimpse of light and she's like, perfect, I'm going to suntan to the best of my ability. So I could understand it. I'm not sure how big the land is. I think that's also a bit of a question mark, right? Because it seems like a fairly big piece of land. I'm not sure how uninhabitable it is, considering it is along the lava flats, but I guess compared to what Mandalore looks like nowadays, it is a haven by comparison.
It's probably dope. Grief was very fixated on that's the saunas where they were, so could be nice, you know, daily spa treatments underneath the armor.
Well, Rich, you're going to have a lot more opportunities to talk about this episode and all its mysteries therein with LaTanya and Brendan this weekend, but anything else you want to mention right now in the recap proper about the pirate?
No, it was a dope episode. Really fun. I love where we're going with this season of The Mandalorian. You know, I know a lot of people have been not as satisfied with it overall. It's been like a kind of bumpy path. Lots of like N1 starfighter dogfighting. He's up, he's down, he's up, he's down. But I am really enjoying season 3. And I think that we're poised in a really, really fun spot for these final 3 episodes. I hope these final 3 episodes are robust. Don't give me these 31-minute episodes, Filoni. I can't deal. I can't take it, man. We waited too long.
I mean, it's tough. As someone who, you know, waits to watch these episodes on a Wednesday morning before all the other stuff that I have to do, I'm not mad at it. I do agree that, like, I always love more Mandalorian, especially when it's good. It is really good. I think people have been understandably having some grumblings about, like, what is the overall arc for this season? Mm-hmm. Where are we going? Considering that, again, something like Din Djarin's redemption happens in the first 3 episodes. This makes me hopeful that we do have a course set now, that we are not blindly flying our X-Wing right now, and we do have a target lock on sight of, okay, the Mandalorians are now finding a home. Now it's a matter of unifying their people, and what does that mean? And that makes me really excited for the last 3 episodes. I thought, much like last week, this episode had a great combination of action-adventure, some surprising character stuff, like some legitimate mystery stuff as well, which is not something we expect from The Mandalorian, but not done in a way that I feel like is particularly cloying like some other mystery box shows. So I've really been enjoying the path that we have been on, and it's only gotten stronger for me in the past couple of weeks. So hopefully that trend continues next week.
Really small note, but treat your Kowaki and monkey lizards well, and they will in turn return that investment. I did love them like blowing up the ambush. That was like amongst my favorite tiny little beats, Mike, of them being like, yes, great use of like the like environment and the animals and stuff. Very cool.
Again, very Return of the Jedi in that regard. Well, Rich, you will return later on this week to talk about more Mandalorian. Otherwise, you've got a bunch of other things happening over on Post Show Recaps. What's been going on with you?
Indeed, I do. Yeah, we will return later in the week with the feedback. You can hit us up, StarWars@postshowrecaps.com if you want to send us an email, or you can find us on Twitter. I'm at DM Philly. My DMs are open. We're in the middle of the Dark rewatch with Grace and Ariel and myself, which is an absolute delight. I just can't overstate how much I love that show and how much fun we're having kind of really digging into it. PSRPGs is back. The first PSRPG Last of Us episode has dropped, part one of what's probably going to be about four parts, but Grace and Jess and Stuart joined me, and we had a really fun little introduction to our Pedro Pascal apocalypse. I think I'm popping up on Post Show Recaps Theater pretty soon, talking about the D&D movie. I expect. I'm excited for that this weekend, but streaming Dungeons and Dragons and a bunch of other stuff over twitch.tv/DM Philly. So give me a follow there. I always appreciate it.
Of course, you can follow me at a Mike Bloom type. I'm staying up in the stars to talk about the aforementioned Star Trek Picard. Josh Wegler and I just finished up our coverage of the anti-penultimate episode of Heroes Season 1, rounding the bend on that. Doing a bunch of Survivor stuff from both the American and Australian versions as well over on Rob Has a Podcast if you are into that. But otherwise, thank you all so much for listening. We've been having so much fun covering The Mandalorian, and I continue to have fun with these episodes as we get through to the next batch and to see what exactly happens. Are Bo and Din going to immediately start the recruitment process? Are we getting a completely different story like we saw with Greef Karga and Captain Teyva? We shall see. Only time will tell. 7 days time, in fact. Thank you all so much for listening. May the Force be with you.
A long time to go. A long time to go. A long time to go. A long time to go.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.